welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 12th of September 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, we have some very interesting news to get into. I don't know whether to say exciting news to get into this week. Shocking news, predictable news, I guess some might say. Of course, we're talking about the death of the Queen of England. And of course, I have here with me today to discuss this my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm absolutely fine, yes. Thank you for allowing me to come on the programme again with you. I think the news today, you were struggling to find a word to describe the news that we need to talk about today. And I would have said that it's inevitable. That's probably the best word to use. We're talking about the death of Queen Elizabeth II, and although she has lived for a very advanced age of 96, death is an inevitability for all of us, and it was an inevitability for her just as much as it was for everybody else. I think some people have had an emotional reaction to the Queen dying today, which kind of reflects that they've held an opinion that they just expected her to go on forever and ever and just never die. But death comes to us all eventually, and it's arrived as far as Elizabeth II is concerned. And it's very sad in many respects, because she was a lady that was greatly loved by a lot of people. She obviously was a very personable individual. She got on very well with the heads of state of various countries all around the world. In fact, she's probably visited more countries around the world and entertained their heads of state and been entertained by them than virtually anybody else throughout history. And so in that respect, she is a very remarkable woman. Some people have expressed criticism of her life and the way she's conducted herself, and I think that criticism at this particular point in time especially is unfounded. There's a long-standing tradition in the Western world that you don't speak ill of the dead. I would argue that a lot of the criticism that's directed towards the Queen is misdirected, and really that it should be directed towards the governments of the time, who, because of the fact that she inherited a constitutional monarchy from her father, it's meant that the politicians of the day, the government of the day, have always been able really to direct the Queen and to not give her really a choice. Unless she wants to bring down the constitutional monarchy, she has never had a choice really over how she has wanted to conduct herself. She's conducted herself in the way that governments have wanted, and we have to recognise that. And so, on the one hand, she is a lady who obviously is a very, as I said, a lovable matriarchal figure for the nation that lots of people have invested a great amount of emotional sort of store in. On the other hand, it can't be denied that her reign has seen the most catastrophic decline in this country's prospects that there's ever been, I would say, throughout history. But I don't think we can blame the Queen for that.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't mean to say that it's exciting that she's died. I just mean it's exciting times. We've got a new Prime Minister, and the Queen of England has just died after, as you say, living for 96 years. It means we're going to have a king on the throne. It's the first time that anything like that's happened to the monarchy in my lifetime. I've never seen a coronation of a monarch. I've never known what a funeral for a monarch is like. And fast paced changes are afoot. And I did see a comment that was left. It's actually been posted in quite a few places. I think it originates from a site called White Papers that I thought pretty much summed up my views on the subject. And they say, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II has died after 70 years on the throne. The monarchy represents a constant for the British and is a central component of the identities of several white nations. It is understandable that many people in nationalist circles were and are not positively predisposed to the late Queen. Her Majesty's reign was one which saw the significant decline of the white nations over which she presided, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. But blame at a moment such as this is far from useful. Nationalists, as people who aspire to rule and govern the nations which we so love, should step back for a moment and consider our words and actions in the coming days. There is no justifiable reason to be ghoulish or to make public statements which would be repulsive to the tens of millions of average white people who have some moral attachment to the late Queen. Be respectful, be considerate of the feelings of those around you, and most importantly, don't make statements and proclamations which will make normal people think that nationalists are a ghoulish bunch who would spit on an old woman, because we are not, and the minority within our own ranks should not be allowed to define us. And I pretty much go along with that. It's not really the time for criticisms. I mean, she was a figurehead for the nation, the matriarch of the nation. It's rather like having a relative, a left-wing relative that's died. I mean, that's not the time or the place to make negative statements about them, and you're just going to look terrible to other people. And we also have to bear in mind that the left-wing press and our opponents, they think the monarchy is completely white supremacist. They talk about Meghan Markle and the way that apparently they were racist to Meghan Markle. And there's a comment, a headline, which was really quite shocking, this one. May her pain be excruciating. Carnegie Mellon Professor Yuju Anaya wishes death on wretched woman Queen Elizabeth II. And this is a black professor at Carnegie. This is one of our opponents, and this is what she has to say. Carnegie Mellon University Professor Yuju Anaya reacted to the news of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II suffering from poor health shortly before her death on Thursday by calling her a wretched woman and a genocidal coloniser who is the chief monarch of a thieving, raping, genocidal empire, adding, may her pain be excruciating. And she also talked about them being white supremacist and all the rest of it. And that's the way our opponents think. So if we're then going to go criticising our figurehead as well, then it seems to me that we're both being played here, aren't we? Or one of us is being played here and getting us to actually cause a bit of an own goal if we start criticising her. I mean, we've had criticisms of the royals here on this show before, but now is really not the right time. And I was trying to think of something positive to say about her, and I'm quite amazed that she was working right up until her death, wasn't she? Because Boris Johnson tendered his resignation the day before she died, and Liz Truss was sworn in the day before she died. So she was literally working right up until the last moment. So you could say that she certainly set a very good example there. As you say, we have a constitutional monarchy, which to me, it seems like we have a monarch that doesn't actually have any power, cannot actually do anything. And we have a constitution, which is supposedly an unwritten constitution, so which is constantly changing. So we don't actually have a written constitution. So a constitutional monarchy seems to me that we don't actually have either. And of course, then you start getting into talking about politics, and this really isn't about politics. I mean, the monarchy itself is an institution that has gone on for thousands of years. And it was always the way that we were ruled. This idea of democracy and voting people in and anybody can actually rule us is a very, very new idea. We've always had leaders, but specific people from specific families with very good genes, high intelligence, very good physique. And clearly there's a eugenic policy behind that, and they would marry other people from the same family that would also have a very good physique and high intelligence. They would be given the very, very best education, and they would be taught from a young age that they were being bred to rule, and they were being taught to rule, and they would be taught to have an empathy with the people. They would not, the idea of selling out the country or selling out the people would be completely alien to them, because what is a king without his people? And you had subjects then as well. And if you're subjects, if you're owned by the king, it's rather like being a part of the king's family. I mean, he is going to stand up for you. And it wasn't that long ago that our kings would lead us into battle, and they would fight on the battlefield, and they would be prepared to lay down their lives for their people. And that's the history of the monarchy. That's the institution. And I think that's really what we have to think about. The state that it's in today is a terrible state. They're not able to actually do anything. And they've been taught from a young age that diversity is a wonderful thing. I mean, look at Prince Harry. and the sort of things that he does and all the promotion of these woke ideas. And that's because that's what he's been taught since a very young age. And I don't think we could have expected Queen Elizabeth to really, really do much else. I mean, her hands are tied. We've all seen the pictures of one of these very, very big bankers pointing a finger at her. And we know that they got themselves into debt. The royal family got themselves into debt to these bankers many, many years ago. And they've had to do what the bankers have said ever since. So that their hands really are tied. And I mean, you can also go back to Good King Charles being murdered, regicide. I mean, we actually killed our king and then put Oliver Cromwell in charge. And if you're going to kill the king, you can't really expect the descendants of the king to then be willing to lay down their lives for their people because you actually killed the king. I mean, it's a shocking thing, but it's not like we're the only nation in Europe to actually do that. That's happened in quite a few different instances. So, I mean, on the one hand, you can say, well, she was the queen and she really should have stood up for us. And on the other hand, you can say, well, we've really sort of sidelined the monarchy, and we've accepted that we have this constitutional democracy, and we've accepted that anyone can rule, even though they haven't been born to rule, they haven't been taught to rule from a young age, or all they've done is managed to climb the greasy pole or climb up the ladder, stepping on everybody else to get to the top so that they can be prime minister for 10 years. So it's the institution that we really have to think about. And it's going to be very interesting to see all the pomp and the ceremony and what happens with the funeral. It's also going to be very interesting to see what happens with the coronation. Personally, I'll be interested to see what happens with Prince William, because Prince Charles had his investiture at Carnarvon Castle. Carnarvon Castle was built by Edward I, Edward Longshanks, and it was where his son was born, and his son was the first Prince of Wales. So it would be interesting to see whether that tradition continues, which apparently is a tradition that goes right the way back to the 12th century, that this investiture would take place in Carnarvon, North Wales. So that will be interesting to see. Interesting to see the funeral. Interesting to see the coronation. Will the coronation chair come out with a stone of scone underneath it? And will the legends around that, will they be talked about? And what will all the coronation stuff look like? All the crown jewels that have been there for centuries. What will the swearing in be like? Will Prince Charles try to change it? He says he wants to, or King Charles III, as he is now, he said that he wants to change it so that he's a defender of the faiths rather than a defender of the faith, because of course the monarch is also the head of the Church of England. So all these interesting things that are going to happen. And as I say, we can say that the Queen was working right up until the last minute, which does set a good example. Any thoughts on any of that, Max?
What I'd say is that I broadly agree with what you're saying there. I think that where there have been criticisms of the Queen coming from nationalist circles, it's been because people haven't realised the closeted life that she's led. You know, that the assumption is that if you're a king or a queen, that you can then boss all your courtiers around, and you can live entirely the life that you want to live and say the things you want to say and do the things you want to do. But you know, that isn't the case, and Elizabeth was born into a role where, I mean, effectively she is similar in position to the queen of a beehive, effectively, where she's tended by various courtiers and things who represent the interests of the crown. And the crown is, you know, they refer to it sort of in jocular fashion as the family firm, but it's the family firm has far greater, or places far greater constraints over the monarch than the monarch, in my view, has the ability to place over the family firm. And so it's the constitutional situation here that is problematic from a nationalist perspective. The fact that over successive generations, really, the royal family have allowed themselves to be progressively cowed by the imposition of the constitutional monarchy and the browbeating that they receive whenever there's even the slightest hint of the monarch expressing their own opinion. And so, know, we don't know what the Queen actually thought about any of the subjects. We don't know how she would have reacted had she had a conversation with somebody who might have put a more nationalistic argument to her. We don't know any of these things. And she's lived a life that's been prescribed by her, for her rather. And that's the you know what we have to bear in mind. And I think from our point of view, the way you know it is, as you said earlier on, it is going to be interesting to watch this kind of all this pomp and circumstance, which really relates to a bygone age. Really, it relates to a bygone age when the monarchy had greater power, and when the and it wasn't so constitutionally hidebound. But it will still be interesting nonetheless. But I think from our point of view, the conversation we should be having about the changeover from the reign of Elizabeth II to the reign of Charles III is the constitutional situation. It could be that Charles will follow in his mother's footsteps and continue to toe the line and tug his forelock to the presiding the governments that preside from time to time, but the it could be different. It could be that Charles has waited his turn, and that Charles will be a far more vigorous monarch of this country and will assert his will far more than his mother did. It remains to be seen. Certainly, so far, he doesn't appear to have strayed from the course set by his mother, which has been, in many respects, a very woke agenda and a woke course that they've followed. Because that is the direction that's been imposed upon them by successive governments. It will be interesting to see how Charles' personality changes the way the monarchy behaves.
I think he's really doing what the oligarchs are instructing him to do, isn't he? I mean, he's supporting the Great Reset. He's supportive of climate change. It just seems like the monarchy is neutered, and particularly King Charles, as he is now. I think at least you could say Queen Elizabeth, she was of an age where she probably was fairly traditionalist. I mean, she ruled at the end of the British Empire as well. So she's gone from the British Empire, when Britain was leading the world, was a great superpower, to what we are now, which is just a small island without much of an army and without much of a navy. Where you were bringing up the pomp and the ceremony and the funeral there, I mean, that's going to be the interesting thing, because it will be the same things that we're seeing that have been seen for centuries. And I think you've really got to have a lot of respect for that. There will be new parts to it. I think that the Queen's body is going to be flown around by an aeroplane, and I think it's going to happen within the next few days as well. So there will be modern sides to it as well, but there'll also be lots of tradition. I don't know what they're going to do with Camilla. Is she going to be Queen Camilla, Dame Camilla, something like that? I'm really not sure. And
she's going to be called Queen Consort, apparently.
Queen Consort. So we'll actually have a king and a queen consort. I forget. Well, the Duke of Edinburgh was just called the Duke of Edinburgh, wasn't he? King Charles is going to be proclaimed at the Accession Council. That happened on Saturday. It's all moving very fast. And I guess we knew this would happen, but I'm quite surprised that it happened now, as I say, because she was working. And I thought we were going to be talking about Liz Truss and Liz Truss's new council today, or the new parliament, and all the people that she's put in charge there. But instead, it's all changed, and it's all about the death of Queen Elizabeth II. I mean, very, very, very fast-paced happenings. I mean, we could talk a little bit about Liz Truss and her cabinet if you want, Max. Unless you've got something else, anything else you want to say about the Queen?
Well, it's just I think that going back to what we originally said about it being inappropriate to speak ill of the dead, The fact of the matter is, as I said, though, an inescapable fact is that, during the reign of Elizabeth II, we have seen this sort of catastrophic decline in our nation's fortunes. One would have hoped that that there would have been a more assertive monarch who would have been more monarchical, I suppose, is perhaps the word to describe it, who would have asserted their will. The Queen appears to have gone along with the dictates of successive governments, though, and hasn't ever spoken out against the things that have been done, which have inevitably brought about the decline and the of a nation. And as I say, this is as a result of sort of decadence that has grown up within the constitutional monarchy, where it's now, it's regarded by most people as sort of almost beyond the pale that the monarch could actually stand up and do anything. But in reality, our monarch exists to safeguard the interests of our people. The army and all of the armed forces swear their allegiance to the monarch. They don't swear their allegiance to the flag, or swear their allegiance to the government, or swear their allegiance to the nation state of the United Kingdom. They swear their allegiance to the monarch. And one would have hoped that the Queen might have had the courage to have spoken out more in the interests of the indigenous British people during her reign. She didn't feel able to do that, or didn't feel inclined to do that. We don't know. And I think really what we need to hope for the future is that Charles is made of sterner stuff and is prepared to speak out in the interests of the indigenous British people, and not, as always, in the interests of the peoples of other nations and the ethnic minorities that exist in this country. But yeah, let's go on and talk about the situation with regard to Liz Truss and her plans for the future.
Yeah, well, I think what you're saying there is you want some substance to go along with the style. It's all style and no substance. And what we really would like to see is some substance with the monarchy as well as the style. And what you were referring to there, Max, about this catastrophic decline in these white nations, and that is represented by the replacement of all the white people in the governments, in our own governments, and particularly with Liz Truss's new government, where all the highest positions in the land have been taken by non-whites. Basically, there are no white males in the highest positions of the land, which a lot of people are commenting on and saying surely this is going to wake people up. But to look on the positive side of it, these people that have been selected by Liz Truss, they do seem to appear to be fairly right wing. They are from the right wing of the Conservative Party. We've got Suella Braverman as Home Secretary, and she wants to pull us out of the European Court of Human Rights. And in actual fact, that was one of her platforms when she was actually standing for Prime Minister herself. She's also spoken about the trans agenda, how that should not be going on in schools, how that people should actually be taking the schools to court if schools are trying to socially transition children, because you cannot actually change your gender on your birth certificate until you are 18. So she has stated, as the Attorney General, that teachers should not be socially transitioning children, and it's unlawful. So she appears to be on the right wing as well. I forget the name of him, not Kwasi Kwarteng, the other black chap that they have there. He seems to be fairly right wing as well. And then I hear that Liz Truss herself,
James Cleverly,
that's it. Yes, James Cleverly. He appears to be in the top 0.5% of the black community. He appears to be fairly right wing. And Liz Truss herself appears to be trying to put a stop to Scotland's Gender Recognition Act. And I don't know the details of it, but I think we can learn enough from the title of it, the Gender Recognition Act. And she's trying to put a stop to that. And also Liz Truss advised all government departments that they should no longer be supporting Stonewall. They should no longer be inviting Stonewall in and getting Stonewall to give diversity training seminars to all the staff. So, I mean, she could turn out to be, I don't know. I mean, perhaps I'm just the eternal optimist. But we could end up seeing this cabinet, which the left-wing press have described as white supremacist gatekeepers. What they're saying is that they've been put there because they're right-wing and they're non-white, and then people can't accuse them of doing right wing things without being accused of being racist. So, I mean, it could turn out that we do have a fairly right wing government now, even though the faces that are fronting it are no longer white. And I mean, we have to face up to the situation we're in. We've had multiculturalism foisted upon us, and there doesn't really appear to be much that we can do about it. So, I mean, to look on the bright side, if we have got right-wing non-whites, I mean, is that better than having left-wing white people? I mean, because there are so many progressive, left-wing, maladapted, self-harming whites that are out there that are also in the government. And if they were in that position, you know, they may be talking about trying to put us back in the EU or opening up the borders, all that sort of thing. I mean, Priti Patel, pretty useless. She did no good whatsoever as Home Secretary. So perhaps Suella Braverman will do better, because at least she has spoken out about these issues. So there's some subjects to think about there, Max. What are your thoughts on Liz Truss and her new cabinet?
Well, it is interesting that, and it's a paradox, really, that ethnic minority individuals quite often do hold views that are not typical, or not what the left would have expected them to hold. And that appears to be the case, as you say, with regard to a number of these people who have been appointed. I think that it's what we've seen with the government of Theresa May and then Boris Johnson and now Liz Truss, is that the cabinet is becoming increasingly composed of people from ethnic minorities. And this is something that those of us that have been active in nationalist politics for decades, as I have, this is something that we predicted was going to happen if immigration continued at the rates that it has been continuing at, and now it's coming true. People laughed at us then and said, oh no, you're being ridiculous, we'd never allow a situation like that to happen. But lo and behold, those people that laughed did allow the thing that they laughed at to happen, and here we are decades later in a situation where the ruling elite within our country is progressively starting to mirror the ethnic backgrounds of the largest growing sections of our population, I suppose. Largest growing because of generally higher birth rates and because of the mass immigration that just continues unabated. I think it's quite telling that the immigration emergency that exists at the moment hasn't been mentioned at all by Liz Truss, during her campaigning for the leadership of the Conservative Party, and not since she's won the competition. You know, she hasn't sort of mentioned the word immigration once, as far as I'm aware, and I don't think the word I don't think immigration has been spoken about in any to any extent since she's appointed her new cabinet members. So what we've seen, which is good, is that Priti Patel, you know, since Priti Patel stepped down, people have pointed out, you know, things that we've been pointing out for weeks now. We've been pointing out the fact that Priti Patel has been very inventive when it comes to thinking up new initiatives that she's going to implement in order to immigration under control, but has been absolutely hopeless in terms of making any of those initiatives work. And so everything she's done has come to naught, which is pretty much the same as the measures that were taken by previous Home Secretaries. And for decades, we've been in a situation where Home Secretaries have conjured up all sorts of programs and all sorts of policies that they're going to implement, which they've then implemented half-heartedly, which have then been eviscerated by the civil servants who are very woke and who've obviously been chosen for their woke credentials. There is this long tradition now of nothing effective ever being done about mass immigration into this country. And it's the same with some other policies as well. You know, the same could be said of the war on drugs in this country. You know, the Home Secretaries have come forward with all sorts of initiatives, none of these initiatives have done anything because the police lack the will to actually arrest, and justice system in this country lacks the will to impose the type of deterrent sentences upon the people who are responsible. And so the drug smuggling into this country and the selling of illicit drugs has continued unabated for decades, in the same way that immigration has continued unabated for decades.
Well, I'll just say, I think Suella Braverman has said about she wants to pull us out of the European Court of Human Rights because of the immigration problem, because we've got this problem with sending back illegal immigrants, sending them to Rwanda. So perhaps she may get on the case with that. And another thing Liz Truss has said is that she wants to see us producing more gas and oil of our own. She said the North Sea is full of oil and full of gas. We need to be getting that back. And she's also talked about fracking. And of course, that is something that we suggested needed to be done on here a couple of weeks back. That was the solution that we were putting forward. So that was that our own resources need to be tapped into, the oil and the gas. So Liz Truss has also been talking about that. I think that she's talked about freezing the electricity and the gas prices where they are, but they're still far too high. That's still going to end up putting a lot of people into poverty. But she does seem to have some plans to deal with it. Something is being done about it at last. So it's just really just a time of rapid change, isn't it? Absolutely very, very, very rapid change. Well, shall we go back to a brighter period in our past and talk about our greatest Britons, Max?
Yes, that'd be great.
Let's talk some more about Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence was born out of wedlock, but still had a fairly middle to upper class upbringing. As a youth, he cycled around collecting brass rubbings and surveying ancient castles, being fascinated by the Crusades and medieval life. As an adult, he first became an archaeologist, working with L.A. Woolley as well as with Flinders Petrie. With Woolley, he surveyed the Negev Desert and at the same time mapped it out for military intelligence to gain the upper hand against the Ottomans in the First World War. He learned a lot about Arab culture and became involved with encouraging Arab ethno-nationalism amongst the Ottomans' subjects, helping to plan and execute the Great Arab Revolt with them. This was expected to result in a huge Arab ethno-state, stretching from Aden in Yemen to Damascus in Syria, but the British reneged on their promise, giving Syria to France and taking Palestine for themselves in order to pass it on to the Jews. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Arab nationalism. But before we do that, I'll just pass it over to you, Max. Is there anything else that you want to add to that recap?
No, I think that, you know, we said in previous weeks that T. Lawrence was a member of the same group of very vigorous men that existed during that period in time. And who were responsible for the much greater status that the UK had during that time. People who took an interest in history, who took an interest in the process of civilization, or the rise of civilization, and who realised that certain things promoted and enhanced civilization, whereas other things caused civilizations to become decadent and stultify. It's pleasing to look back and see that these people such as T.E. Lawrence existed. And what we must hope for the future is that men of his ilk come forward again and fill positions of influence and power in our country, and so that the vigour of our nation is restored.
Yeah, it was sort of peak alpha male time for Britain. We had more intellectuals, more highly intelligent people, just very, very strong, good examples of our phenotype. And I guess that would have been because the weak and the sickly were still dying at this time. If you actually managed to make it through to adulthood, then you would have had a very strong constitution. And with the strong constitution, you would have also been very bright. So as you pointed out, we had lots of polymaths that were around at this time. And it was really, I think it was the peak of Britain round about this time when we had the British Empire just before the start of the First World War. And we had people that were just very good at everything that they did, and they didn't just concentrate on one thing. They concentrated on lots of different things. As we said, Lawrence was interested in castles, the Crusades. He was a great archaeologist, and he worked with these other great archaeologists as well, L.A. Woolley and Sir Flinders Petrie. And at the same time, he was an amazing spy as well, learning different languages. And of course, you can also tie this in with a little bit later on. We had Enoch Powell, another amazing intellectual and an incredible politician. All these amazing men that we used to have that just don't seem to appear nowadays. And of course, the IQ level is dropping on average every year, and it becomes more and more less likely that we're going to actually have more of these genius types that were good at everything. Well, let's move into a closer look at Arab nationalism then. The rise of nationalism in the Ottoman Empire dates from at least 1821. Arab nationalism has its roots in the Mashriq, which is the Arab lands east of Egypt, particularly in the countries of the Levant. The political orientation of Arab nationalists before World War I was generally moderate. Their demands were of a reformist nature and generally limited to autonomy, a greater use of Arabic in education, and changes in peacetime conscription in the Ottoman Empire to allow Arab conscripts local service in the Ottoman army. And this reminds me of the British wanting to be allowed into the Roman army, and the Vandals wanting to be allowed into the Roman army. And it just seems surprising when you think about it that people would want to go and join another people's army. But apparently that's so. I mean, why do you think that is, Max? Why would they be campaigning to be allowed to join the Ottoman army, do you think?
I think that there probably would have been a perception on the part of many Arabs that the Ottomans were of a similar genetic stock to them. There would have been more Turks, more people of Turkish origins amongst the Ottomans, I suppose. But the whole of the Middle East is effectively a mixture of peoples, ranging from Arabs through Turks and Hamites along the north coast of Africa. And what are described as people of Nilotic origin in the Nile Valley. And I think that there's an old saying that nothing succeeds like success. Everybody loves a winner. And if you see if you are born into a community which is marginalized, but right next door to and adjacent to an empire that's being forged by people who seem to have greater energy and greater determination and fortitude, then that success becomes an attractive thing in itself and makes people want to join in.
Well, I guess they wanted to be seen as equals, didn't they? The Arabs wanted to be seen as equals to the Ottomans, so they wanted to join the Ottoman Empire, and the same with the British and the Roman Empire and the Vandals with the Roman Empire. So that explains it. In 1913, intellectuals and politicians from the Mashriq met in Paris at the First Arab Congress. They produced a set of demands for greater autonomy and equality within the Ottoman Empire, including for elementary and secondary education in Arab lands to be delivered in Arabic, for peacetime Arab conscripts to the Ottoman army to serve near their home region, and for at least three Arab ministers in the Ottoman cabinet. So they wanted representation as well. By 1916, the Arabs were wanting their own single, unified and independent Arab state, stretching from Aleppo in Syria to Aden in Yemen, which the British had promised to recognise if the Arabs would succeed in a revolt against the Ottomans. So they've gone on from wanting to be taught in Arabic because they're Arabs, to wanting representation in the government of the empire, to now wanting an ethnostate. So, you know, it's a quite natural thing to want to be with your own people. And the British promised that they would recognise this, they would give the Arabs this state if they would revolt against the Ottomans, because remember, they were serving under the Ottomans with this conscription. The main contribution of the Arab revolt to the war was to pin down tens of thousands of Ottoman troops who otherwise might have been used to attack the Suez Canal, which is owned by Britain, and conquering Damascus, allowing the British to undertake offensive operations with a lower risk of counterattack. This was indeed the British justification for supporting the revolt, a textbook example of asymmetric warfare that has been studied time and again by military leaders and historians alike. The great weakness of the Ottoman forces was that they were at the end of a long and tenuous supply line in the form of the Hejaz Railway, and because of their logistical weaknesses, they were often forced to fight on the defensive. Ottoman offences against the Hashemite forces more often than not faltered due to supply problems rather than the actions of the enemy. The Sharifan army, led by Hussein and the Hashemites with military backing from the British Egyptian Expeditionary Force, successfully fought and expelled the Ottoman military presence from much of the Hejaz and Transjordan. The rebellion eventually took Damascus and set up the Arab Kingdom of Syria, a short-lived monarchy led by Faisal, a son of Hussein. Following the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Middle East was later partitioned by the British and French into mandate territories rather than as a unified Arab state, and the British reneged on their promise to support a unified, independent Arab state. And this is really the reason why the Jews would say about the Palestinians, well, can't they just go to another country? And we'll say, ah, yes, but you can't just move to another country. But back then, the Arabs were wanting the whole area. They were wanting from Yemen to Syria to be this Arabic ethno-state. So what the Jews are effectively saying is, well, it doesn't matter. Surely the Palestinians can just move to that Transjordan area, which is an Arab area. Why do they have to have this area? So, you know, you have to look at what things were like back then, what the Arabs were asking for, and what they have now. It's not like those countries that we see in the Middle East, they've always been there. Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, the way that it is now. It was that they wanted this whole area, and the Arabs themselves were nomadic. They would move from one place to another. And again, this all ties in with the birth of Israel and the Balfour Agreement, which took place after this. And it looks like Lawrence was not aware of this, that the British were going to go back on their promise. And he supported the Arabs. Any thoughts on any of that, Max?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that all the Arabs were nomadic, and so therefore they shouldn't really have had a claim to any of the land. I think that some Arabic tribes have traditionally been nomadic, but there are lots of Arab peoples, particularly those that lived in Palestine and the Levant, who would have been settled. If you think back through history, I think Damascus is the oldest city in the world. Actually, it's claimed to be the oldest city in the world, and it's the center of cereal domestication and the growing of domestic cereal crops in order to provide food. And so the people who have lived traditionally around Damascus, they would have been settled for millennia, and so that they would have a claim to the land just as strong as any other indigenous people, basically. But the denial of their rights and the aspirations to have this sort of Arab state led ultimately to the creation of Baathism, spelt B-A-A-T-H, Baathism, which is an Arab form of a mixture of nationalism and socialism. The man who's credited with forming Baathism was a chap called Michel Aflaq, and he was a great admirer of Marx and also of Lenin, as well as other nationalist leaders in the 20th century.
Yeah, the Ba'ath Party is Bashar al-Assad is a leader of the Ba'ath Party. I think the Ba'ath Party had representation in all these different Arab countries originally, and it was supportive of nationalism, and that's another reason why they're against the Syrians, I guess, is because they go back to this Ba'ath Party that had support from National Socialism. I think they have a National Socialist Party or a Socialist Nationalist Party over there in Syria. They certainly had a strong sense of ethnic solidarity, and they had this ethno-nationalism movement, which was being used by the British. So the British were using them as proxies against the Ottomans. And as it says here, I mean, that's asymmetrical warfare. It's still used today. I mean, we can see similar things sort of happening in Ukraine, being used as a proxy against Russia. And we saw that the rebels were being used as a proxy against Gaddafi in Libya. The same with the Syrian rebels are being used as a proxy against Syria. So we had the same thing that was going on back then. And these Arabs were basically being used by Britain to try and weaken the Ottomans. And this Sykes-Picot agreement, this was a 1916 secret treaty between the United Kingdom and France, with assent from the Russian Empire and the Kingdom of Italy, to define their mutually agreed spheres of influence and control in an eventual partition of the Ottoman Empire. The agreement was based on the premise that the Triple Entente would achieve success in defeating the Ottoman Empire during World War I and form part of a series of secret agreements contemplating its partition. The primary negotiations leading to the agreement took place between 23rd of November 1915 and 3rd of January 1916, on which date the British and French diplomats Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot initialed an agreed memorandum, and the agreement was ratified by their respective governments on the 9th and the 16th of May 1916. The agreement effectively divided the Ottoman provinces outside the Arabian Peninsula into areas of British and French control and influence. The British and French-controlled countries were divided by the Sykes-Picot line. The agreement allocated to the UK control of what is today southern Israel and Palestine, Jordan and southern Iraq, and an additional small area that included the ports of Haifa and Acre to allow access to the Mediterranean. And France was to control southeastern Turkey, the Kurdistan region, Syria and Lebanon. So you can see these original countries were sort of split in half by this line. As a result of the included Sazonov-Paleologue agreement, Russia was to get Western Armenia in addition to Constantinople, and the Turkish Straits already promised under the 1915 Constantinople Agreement. Italy assented to the agreement in 1917 via the agreement of Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne and received southern Anatolia. The Palestine region, with a smaller area than the later Mandatory Palestine, was to fall under an international administration. I think that's why it still falls under UN administration. But this is the first that I've actually heard of this. So Constantinople was promised to Russia. So why is it now part of Turkey? Why did the Turks get Constantinople back? You would have thought that Eastern Orthodox Russia would have wanted to keep a hold of that. Any idea, Max? Do you know about this agreement here, that it went to Russia?
No, not specifically. I can only assume. I mean, there has been fighting between the various nations in and around the Black Sea for many decades, and so what will have probably happened is that during the Second World War, probably there would have been a stronger effort made by the Turks to secure the Straits of the Bosporus, and because it may well be that so the Turks fought on our side instead of fighting on the side of the Germans as they did during the First World War, that the Allies may have allowed them to have the Straits of the Bosporus, perhaps conditionally maintained the Straits as an international waterway rather than using it as a means of dominating trade backwards and forwards between the Black Sea areas and the rest of the Mediterranean.
Well, you can also see from this, we learn about the Versailles Treaty and how that set up the Second World War, and it partitioned Germany and gave bits of Germany to Poland and what have you. And we can see the same thing was happening here. You know, bits of Turkey are being given to Russia, bits of Armenia go to Russia, Italy gets certain parts, France gets a little bit of Turkey. Kurdistan region, which is just a region which didn't actually end up with a country, even though there is the Kurds, the ethnic group, there's Kurds in Iraq, Turkey, Iran, Syria, they're in all these places, but they actually have a region, but they weren't actually given a country. So you can see that it wasn't just the Germans that were upset after the end of the First World War. All these countries.
And it's because of the Sykes-Picot agreement that that a lot of these countries in the Middle East, that their boundaries are just straight lines. That somebody has just obviously got a map of the Middle East, put a ruler on it, and then just drawn a line straight across, saying, right, everybody north of that, or all the land north of that is going to be called Iraq, for example, and all the land south of that is going to be called Saudi Arabia, and then drawn another line, all the land to the east of that is going to be called Syria, the rest of it's going to be called Lebanon, and this, you know, and it's been divided up that way. And you're quite right, as far as the Kurds are concerned. The Kurds have occupied an area of, eastern Anatolia for thousands of years. They've always been dragged backwards and forwards by various stronger powers throughout history, and when the modern day boundaries were decided, somebody took their ruler and drew across the Kurdish areas and divided Kurdistan into, I don't know, four or five different chunks each, then that would fall under the auspices of a different local power.
You can see it's just setting up strife, isn't it? I mean, you can see why there's so much trouble in the Middle East, because you've got these different ethnic groups that have been told, right, well, this is your country. I mean, how are you going to get any patriotic feeling there for a country when half your relatives are living in the country next door because there's a line that's just been drawn down the map there? You know, you're not going to get the national feeling that you need from a shared ethnicity, which is, you know, why the Arabs had this ethno-nationalism and why they wanted this ethno-state in the first place. So, you know, it's just setting up problems for the future. It doesn't just happen with Europeans. Or getting back to Lawrence of Arabia here and the Arab revolt. The revolt began in June 1916, but it got bogged down after a few successes with a real risk that the Ottoman forces would advance along the coast of the Red Sea and recapture Mecca. So they actually captured Mecca, the most holiest city to do with Islam. On the 16th of October 1916, Lawrence was sent to the Hejaz on an intelligence-gathering mission led by Ronald Storrs. He interviewed Sharif Hussein's sons, Ali, Abdullah and Faisal, and he concluded that Faisal was the best candidate to lead the revolt. And remember, Faisal was made into the king. In November, S.F. Newcomb was assigned to lead a permanent British liaison to Faisal's staff. Newcomb had not yet arrived in the area and the matter was of some urgency, so Lawrence was sent in his place. In late December 1916, Faisal and Lawrence worked out a plan for repositioning the Arab forces to put the railway from Syria under threat while preventing the Ottoman forces around Medina from threatening the Arab positions. Newcomb arrived while Lawrence was preparing to leave Arabia, but Faisal intervened urgently, asking that Lawrence's assignment become permanent. So they preferred to have Lawrence leading them rather than Newcomb. Lawrence's most important contributions to the Arab revolt were in the area of strategy and liaison with the British armed forces, but he also participated personally in several military engagements. An attack on the Ottoman outpost in the Hejaz, an attack on the railway at Abba el Nam, an attack on a bridge at Ras Baalbek, defeat of the Ottoman forces of Abba el-Lisan, an outpost of Aqaba, attack on the railway near Madwara, attack on the railway, destroying an engine. Following a failed attack on the Yarmouk bridges, he blew up a train on the railway between Deraa and Amman, suffering several wounds in the explosion and ensuing combat. Remember, this is an archaeologist. I mean, he was an archaeologist, then he was a spy, and now he's a marine. 1918, the Battle of Tafila, a region southeast of the Dead Sea, with Arab regulars under the command of Jafar Pasha al-Askari. The battle was a defensive engagement that turned into an offensive rout and was described in the official history of the war as a brilliant feat of arms. Lawrence was awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his leadership at Tafila and was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. March 1918, attack on the railway near Aqaba. He also made an attack using British armoured cars on Tel Sham, destruction of a railway bridge between Amman and Deraa, and in September 1918, an attack on retreating Ottomans and Germans near the village of Tafas. The Ottoman forces massacred the villagers, and then the Arab forces in return massacred their own prisoners, with Lawrence's encouragement. Lawrence made a 300-mile personal journey northwards in June 1917 on the way to Aqaba, visiting Ras Baalbek, the outskirts of Damascus, and Azraq, Jordan. He met Arab nationalists, counselling them to avoid revolt until the arrival of Faisal's forces, and he attacked a bridge to create the impression of guerrilla activity. His findings were regarded by the British as extremely valuable, and there was serious consideration of awarding him a Victoria Cross, but in the end he was invested as a Companion of the Order of the Bath and promoted to Major. Lawrence travelled regularly between British headquarters and Faisal, coordinating the military action, but by early 1918, Faisal's chief British liaison was Colonel Piers Charles Joyce, and Lawrence's time was chiefly devoted to raiding and intelligence gathering. So he must have really lived as an Arab at this time, as a spy and leading the troops here in all these activities. And you remember, this guy was just trained as an archaeologist, and suddenly he's leading these Arab forces and having all these successes as well. I mean, he's got to have a lot of courage there, hasn't he? Do you think?
Yeah, I think he was one of these characters that exhibited what used to be called derring do, who was an adventurer and who was more than willing to risk his life in the pursuit of those adventures, basically, and the sort of person that romantic action stories are written about, and that's one of the reasons why his name has perpetuated in history, and he's become as famous as he has.
Yeah, and we're talking about 100 years later. But the chief elements of the Arab strategy, which Faisal and Lawrence developed, were to avoid capturing Medina and to extend northwards through Ma'an and Deraa to Damascus and beyond. Faisal wanted to lead regular attacks against the Ottomans, but Lawrence persuaded him to drop that tactic. Lawrence wrote about the Bedouin as a fighting force. The value of the tribes is defensive only, and their real sphere is guerrilla warfare. They are intelligent and very lively, almost reckless, but too individualistic to endure commands or to fight in a line or to help each other. It would, I think, be possible to make an organised force out of them. The Hejaz War is one of dervishes against regular forces, and we are on the side of the dervishes. Our textbooks do not apply to its conditions at all. So you've got the racial character there as well. It's difficult to get an organised force out of them. They're too individualistic, but they're very intelligent and very lively. And he's talking about the dervishes there. I think they're the Sufis. So that was a particular type of Islam were the dervishes and the Sufis, whirling dervishes. Medina was an attractive target for the revolt as Islam's second holiest site, and because its Ottoman garrison was weakened by disease and isolation. It became clear that it was advantageous to leave it there rather than try to capture it while attacking the Hejaz railway south from Damascus without permanently destroying it. This prevented the Ottomans from making effective use of their troops at Medina and forced them to dedicate many resources to defending and repairing the railway line, because they've got to get their supplies. It is not known when Lawrence learned the details of the Sykes-Picot agreement, nor if or when he briefed Faisal on what he knew. However, there is good reason to think that both these things happened, and earlier rather than later. In particular, the Arab strategy of northwards extension makes perfect sense given the Sykes-Picot language that spoke of an independent Arab entity in Syria, which would only be granted if the Arabs liberated the territory themselves. The French and some of their British liaison officers were specifically uncomfortable about the northwards movement, as it would weaken French colonial claims. So I guess he would have ended up with split loyalties there. Should my loyalties be to the Arabs, who I've spent all this time with, building up a bond with them, or should my loyalties be to Britain and what Britain wants at the end of the war? And he seems to have been trying to help the Arabs here by directing them to go north and to take Syria, so that they ended up being given Syria, I think. Any thoughts on that, Max?
No, I think your interpretation there is quite correct. You know that his loyalties would have been split. I think that because he'd spent so long with the Arabs, you know, he would have gone native, in inverted commas, as they say, and that he would have been very strongly emotionally invested in the interests of the Arab allies that he had mustered and that he'd organized and directed in the war against the Ottomans. And so, I think he would have had strong feelings, and he would have wanted an outcome for the Arabs that the Arabs would have regarded as being equitable. Obviously the agreement that had been reached, the Sykes-Picot agreement, wasn't that.
Yeah, it was going to deny them this huge great ethno-state. In 1917, Lawrence proposed a joint action with the Arab irregulars and forces, including Audu Abu Tayy, who had previously been in the employ of the Ottomans, against the strategically located but lightly defended town of Aqaba on the Red Sea. Aqaba could have been attacked from the sea, but the narrow defiles leading through the mountains were strongly defended and would have been very difficult to assault. The expedition was led by Sharif Nazir of Medina. Lawrence avoided informing his British superiors about the details of the planned inland attack due to concern that it might be blocked as being contrary to French interests. The expedition departed from Wedge on 9th of May, and Aqaba fell to the Arab forces on the 6th of July after a surprise overland attack which took the Turkish defences from behind. After Aqaba, General Sir Edmund Allenby, the new commander-in-chief of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, agreed to Lawrence's strategy for the revolt. Lawrence now held a powerful position as an advisor to Faisal and a person who had Allenby's confidence, as Allenby acknowledged after the war, saying, "I gave him a free hand. His cooperation was marked by the utmost loyalty, and I never had anything but praise for his work, which indeed was invaluable throughout the campaign. He was the mainspring of the Arab movement and knew their language, their manners, and their mentality." So he was really the leader of the Arab nationalist movement, was this white guy all dressed up in Arab uniform. I mean, that's the famous picture of him, isn't it?
That's right.
Lawrence describes an episode on the 20th of November 1917 while reconnoitering Deraa in disguise, when he was captured by the Ottoman military, beaten and sexually assaulted by the local bey and his guardsmen, although he does not specify the nature of the sexual contact. Some scholars have stated that he exaggerated the severity of the injuries that he suffered, or alleged that the episode never happened. There is no independent testimony, but the multiple consistent reports and the absence of evidence for outright invention in Lawrence's works makes the account believable to some of his biographers. Malcolm Brown, Johnny Mack, and Jeremy Wilson have argued that this episode had strong psychological effects on Lawrence, which may explain some of his unconventional behaviour in later life. Lawrence ended his account of the episode in Seven Pillars of Wisdom with the statement, "In Deraa that night, the citadel of my integrity had been irrevocably lost." Poor man. I mean, he was really tortured there. He's lucky to live. I mean, I guess they must have not worked out who he was, and they just beat him and assaulted him, but they didn't actually know who he was. I mean, if they'd known who he was, I think they would have kept him, and he wouldn't have managed to escape. I mean, the horrors that this man withstood, basically, for his country. Lawrence was involved in the build-up to the capture of Damascus in the final weeks of the war, but he was not present at the city's formal surrender, much to his disappointment. He arrived several hours after the city had fallen, entering Damascus around 9 a.m. on 1st of October 1918. The first to arrive was the 10th Australian Light Horse Brigade, led by Major ACN Harry Alden, who accepted the formal surrender of the city from acting governor Emir Said. Lawrence was instrumental in establishing a provisional Arab government under Faisal in newly liberated Damascus, which he had envisioned as the capital of an Arab state. Faisal's rule as king, however, came to an abrupt end in 1920, that's just 2 years later, after the Battle of Maysalun, when the French forces of General Gerard entered Damascus under the command of General Mariano Goybe, destroying Lawrence's dream of an independent Arabia. During the closing years of the war, Lawrence sought to convince his superiors in the British government that Arab independence was in their interests, but he met with mixed success. The secret Sykes-Picot agreement between France and Britain contradicted the promises of independence that he had made to the Arabs and frustrated his work. So he was really let down by his superiors. And I think he's been proved true, but been, you know, his fears have been proven to be true when we look at the troubles that we see in the Middle East now, as we were saying, with these lines that have been drawn there. And I mean, he knew that people of one ethnicity, they want to be together with their ethnicity. They don't want to be split up. Multiculturalism doesn't work. So he's saying it would have been in Britain's interests to give these Arabs the state that they wanted. But maybe even the Balfour Agreement played into this, and this wish to give Palestine to the Jews, because I think that would have played a part in it, wouldn't it? I'm trying to think where Yemen is on the map. If it stretches,
Yemen is the very southernmost corner of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. So you'd have to travel south from Mecca. Mecca is quite close to Aqaba, and quite close to the southern part of Israel. But if you then travel along the northern coast of the Red Sea, south, where you reach the corner of the Arabian Peninsula, that's where Aden is.
So it might have actually left out that part anyway, this Arab state. Surely not, because the Palestinians were Arabs, weren't they? So that must have formed a part of it. So I guess maybe that played into it. You know, this idea that they wanted to give the Jews that part, that little part.
Well, are you saying that the Sykes-Picot Agreement wanted to give the Jews Aden as well?
No. I'm saying that the British, why they didn't want to support this ethno-state. I mean, part of it may have been that they wanted to give Palestine to the Jews, because, I mean, it doesn't really make sense wouldn't.
I think that's obviously the reason why. You know, the Balfour Declaration had been made so that international Jewry would campaign in the United States to bring the Americans into the First World War on the side of the Allies. In return for international Jewry doing that, the Balfour Declaration was signed promising the Jews a homeland in Palestine.
So that definitely would have played into this then. It's a shame they didn't get their ethno state, you know. And it's good that they had this sense of nationalism and this sense of ethnic solidarity, and rather like we see men doing better as women today. We see Lawrence of Arabia being the best of the Arabs. It was actually a white man that was leading them. Well, I guess we'll talk some more about Lawrence of Arabia in the next episode, I think, Max, and we'll end it here. So thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.